when we were at CMU, there were just two rules about the games that we cannot make, right? Don't make any shooting games and don't make any pornography games. And it's not because they have anything fundamentally against like shooting or pornography, but they're boring. Like there's no innovation there. Everyone has made a shooting game, and pornography is just like, it's not solving an interesting problem. You're not doing anything innovative. So they're like, you can do that if you feel like, but it's not creatively stimulating. So do something a little bit more ambitious with your creativity.
Hello there, and welcome to Ruben's Podcast, a show where I speak to people about their lives over the last decade and the lessons they've learned along the way. If you're new here, some quick notes before we get into today's episode. If you'd like to follow the podcast, you can find us on Instagram and subscribe to our newsletter. On Instagram, we are at Ruben's Podcast, and the newsletter is at rubenspodcast.substack. If you enjoy this episode and the podcast in general, you can consider supporting the show by buying me a coffee. But if that's too much, you can leave us a review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening to this. It makes me happy and helps the show reach more people. You can find all the links in the show notes. Okay, with that, let's get into today's conversation. Jerry T. John on the pod. Jerry, welcome to Ruben's Podcast. Where in the world are you based right now?
Hey Ruben, thanks for having me. I am currently based out of Bangalore.
The new Silicon Valley, yeah? is it really so? Is it really as buzzing as people claim?
It's got a different energy than Delhi, because I've been born and raised in Delhi all my life. And the whole mindset in Delhi is very set in its ways. So here, the whole company ethos is more like try new things, break things, and move. So it's a younger person city than Delhi is.
I see.
Delhi's a little bit uncle auntie's who are in their like 50s and set in their ways.
Yeah,
It's run by those people. So it bleeds into the personality of the city, I guess.
I see. And are there like instances or examples, things which you encounter like every day that reminds you that Bangalore is a young city versus Delhi, which is an uncle
auntie? It's mostly because of the work that I do. So I've jumped between four companies now, and all of them like trying different things. Within 5 years, I've jumped between four companies, and everyone is. There's a different pace on the treadmill. Like there's a runway that everyone is running out of. Before that, we need to take off. So
yeah. I see. Okay, so before we get into what these four companies etc. are, let me give you a quick brief of what Jerry has been up to since we graduated. So I met Jerry back in 2010. This was back in Stephens. Jerry was studying physics.
Yes,
in college,
physics.
And we were also living in the same residence block. So were you in Mook East all 3 years?
Yes, I was.
Yes, you were.
Yeah, I was.
We were in Mook East all 3 years.
Yeah. Do you know that they like locked off the back of Mook East? Like they caged off the back door entrances. So it's like a little prison now. So it's.
Yes. Apparently, I think there are like you can only enter. So there's only one way in and out, which is the main door, and the arches are all locked up. A lot of the women would say that's exactly how our RS blocks have been all along. But yeah, I think I did see, which is quite weird, right? But anyway, so Jerry and I were stay together in Mukherjee East, which is one of the residence blocks at Stephens. You studied physics. For a few people who remember, and I vividly did remember. So when you send me the link of that game, I was like, oh my God, I haven't seen this game in like a decade. Jerry submitted that game. He had created a random stick figure game of people like fighting each other on different backgrounds of college, and you could sort of take people's faces and stick them on the stick figure. So there were faces of our professors, of the principal, of many other people. So it's quite entertaining. But as you mentioned, Jerry submitted that to university, and you went to Carnegie Mellon for game design, which is insane. And ever since, you've been in the world of game design. You spent a few years in the US working there. You then moved back to India. As you just mentioned, you've been hopping around. You work on some pretty cool stuff now, which, of course, I think we may not go through on the pod, but I will surely leave links in the show notes so people can go check out. So yeah, that's roughly what Jerry's been up to. I would never imagine that you're in the world of game design, but we're going to be talking about a bunch of those things on today's podcast, along with some pretty cool topics like honesty and mischief. you mentioned in your voice notes. I was like, interesting.
Yes.
So maybe a good place to start, Jerry. College, 2010 to 2013. That's almost 10 years ago. You know, 13 or 12 if you look at it from the day we entered.
Yeah.
What's your favorite memory from your time at Stephens?
My favorite memory is in first year. I think we were about to go on a class trip, right? And a bunch of us, like day skis, were staying back and we were wondering what to do. And Leon had mentioned to me that there is a way to climb up to the cross, the Stephen's Cross. And a bunch of us, I think some of them you've had on your podcast. There was Lipsa, Dhruv, Archishman Pradhan. There was Sujit Narayan and Paulumi. I don't know if you remember Paulumi Ganguly. These are the people I remember. And then Leon had vaguely described the route to me, and I'm like, that makes sense, but I'd never like tested it out. And it was nighttime, like it was around dinner time, 8 p.m. People were still having dinner in the mess, and we were just hanging out, and I'm like, you want to go up to the cross? And they were like, fuck yeah, you know how to do that? and I was like, yeah, I've heard about it. So we snuck up, and then we climbed on top of this water tank that is, and then using the tanki, we climbed on top of the roof, and then we felt so badass. It was like a bank heist. And then we snuck up to that, the column, right? The tower, right? And there was this like rusty old ladder in complete darkness. Like there was a small window up on the top where you could see the stars through there. And I was like, that is it. And we climbed up that ladder, and it was a beautiful starlit night. And the five of us, and it was like Delhi at the beginning of winter. So the weather was also just perfect. And we felt really, really mischievous, and like we had pulled off the most badass thing ever. And we sat there, enjoyed the starlit night, came back down feeling like we were on top of the world, and then we went on our class trip. So that was a fond memory.
I don't know if I should admit this, but I've actually never been up to the cross. I don't think I had the balls to go.
That's go all what the I'm way saying, up. Man. Mischief just makes your life a little bit better.
Tell me something on the way up of that tower. Is it like a closed ladder, or is it like open? That means if you slip and fall, you're basically falling, I don't know, like 3-4 stories.
Two stories, to be exact.
Oh. and you just fall.
Yeah, it's like an. It's like maybe a 20 feet by 20 feet room that extends upwards for two stories, right? And then there's just this one ladder that's going up into a sunroof. And you can, like, if you make too much noise, the inside will sort of echo, right? And then there's always this worry that, you know, the sounds that you're making, is it echoing down? Like, can the guards hear you? But there are no guards. Like, no one, everyone downstairs is just in their own world. So no one really notices unless you're making a ruckus. So it felt like more danger than it actually was, which is exciting.
Oh, man. Yeah, I remember going to the cross was always a thing. I think in first year it was much more common. I think by the time we reached third year, it became really, really hard. I think they locked up stuff and things like that. But interesting. Very, very interesting. Okay, so let's talk about like game design. First of all, how come, like, talk to me about what was happening when you decided to make that stick figure game. And for people who don't remember it, I'm going to leave in a link in the show notes. The soundtrack is pretty crazy because when I heard that, I was like, oh, the last time I think I heard this song was also in college. But how did you decide to make that game in the first place?
Okay. So, you have had Priyanka on your show, right? And
yes.
Priyanka was in physics honors with me. And we had a very friendly, competitive relationship because the best thing about coming into Stephens was that you are suddenly in a room full of people who are smarter than you are and more talented than you are, and maybe just talented in different ways. And Priyanka was one of those people whom I admired, and I wanted to level with her and like earn her respect. You know, that's if you ever find yourself being the smartest person in the room, you really need to find a bigger room. And Stephens for me was the first like bigger room I entered, and there were people around me whom I just wanted to be friends with and earn their respect because they made me better. And Priyanka would make these like generative art, like she used to make mathematical art. She put a few equations and then let random numbers decide where those equations would be, and then these beautiful colorful curves that felt very artistic would just emerge on screen. And I'm like, I need to prove to this girl that I am as good as her, or if not better, right? So we were casual friends then, but we didn't really talk. But I saw that thing that she showed me, and I'm like, listen, we need to decide which of us is better, because she said she was the better programmer, and I said bullshit. So we gave each other a 1 month like challenge. Okay, you make a game in a month, I'll make a game in a month, and we just let the class decide who is the better programmer. And she had made some knockoff version of Minesweeper, and I made GPL 2012. And the class obviously went crazy for GPL 2012. And now she's a scientist, and I am a game designer. And
fate, your fate was decided on that competition.
Yeah, it was. Because until that point...
What was the full form of GPL 2012?
So I was just making this Mortal Kombat clone with my classmates' heads stuck on it, right? And Kunal Joshi, he saw that and he's like, you should call this Gandpalath. And Gandpalath means kick on the ass, right? I was like, that's perfect, but let's just call it GPL 2012. And this came up later in my US visa interview. So I went to the Delhi US visa office, and then this lady who was in front of me, like she was maybe in her like late 20s. She was an Indian American, so she spoke Punjabi as well. And she was just interviewing people to see whether they are the kind of people to go to the US and just stay there and cause trouble, or whether they're going for legitimate reasons and whether we should give them the visa, right? And she asked me, so why are you going? I said, I'm going to study game design and entertainment technology. She's like, so what games have you made before? And then I described this game, GPL 2012, that I had made. And she's like, what does GPL stand for? And I was like, Gandpalath. And she just like, she was, this smile went on her face. And then immediately she was like suspicious. And then I explained it to her. And she was like, so what kind of people did you put in the game? Like, I think she was trying to suss out whether I was doing it in some kind of prejudiced way, and if I was just kicking the ass of, let's say, Muslim people or whatever. I was just like, fun people who wouldn't mind having a laugh at themselves, being Mortal Kombat characters on screen. She immediately like stamped my visa and let me go through, even though I said like Gandpalath on the visa interview.
Amazing. Well, you managed to get through. So that worked. Okay. So that is why you decided to make the game in the first place. Did you know at any point before doing that you would eventually land up in game design? Like, had you ever even thought about it or?
It was a aspiration. In the sense, because I've loved games forever. So since I played like Prince of Persia in 1994, right? I saw this and I'm like, this is awesome. But I always looked up to game designers as if they were gods, like people who can do things that I just will never be able to do. So it was always this tangential aspiration, the same way being an astronaut is a tangential aspiration when you're a kid. Like at some level, you know that it's unattainable. But at some point in school, I had gone for this science exhibition, right? And I had worked on some mathematical modeling of cancer, very primitive stuff. But it was the kind of thing that won the competition, right? So I gave some explanation of mathematical modeling of cancer, and I won. But there was this stall next to me where this guy had made a racing simulator game, right? And he had made a like he was our age, and he had made a 3D racing simulator game, and he was using it to sort of, like, the pitch for the science fair was that, you know, this will simulate vehicle collisions, and then we can test vehicles in different conditions without actually having to crash them. But the judges were just so old, like Delhi auntie uncle judges, who were like, why are you making games? We are talking about science. And I felt like that guy deserved to win.
Yeah.
But I won, right? And I felt like if he can do it, I can do it. And that seed of a thought just festered in my mind. Not festered, it grew. And when I came in contact with Priyanka, who was someone who was equally talented as me, or perhaps even more, like in a different way, I felt like I had something to prove to her. So then those two, like, just like the seeds of inspiration from different people who I recognized like talent in, I'm like, if they have something that they can do with their talent, then I have something that I can as well. And I need to bring that out.
Fascinating. Do you know what that other guy is up to, or like do you know?
I hope he's in game design, bro. That guy deserves to be, like, if I manage to pursue my dreams of game design and development, and I'm here, he deserves to be there as well. I don't know. He's from a different school, and he's gone his own way, but I hope he found his way into the industry.
That's awesome. Okay, so for the uninitiated, how would you describe game design, and what is game design, and how would you explain that to a five-year-old?
Okay, so I'm going to explain it in the analogy of chess, right? So the game designer is the guy who makes the rules of chess, balances the rules so that they are interesting and create emergent experiences. The gameplay programmer is the guy who makes it playable on the computer. And the gameplay artist is the guy who makes the chess pieces, makes the board, makes the theme for the board. Like, if you wanted to decide that this is a Harry Potter themed chess board, then you would artistically make every piece. So, like, that's the main distinction I want to create is between gameplay programmers and gameplay designers. Because some people outside the industry think that, oh, you make games, you must be a programmer. And that's not necessarily true. I walk both fields. Like, I make interesting rules and I implement them as well. But think of it this way. So gameplay programmers solve interesting problems. Game designers create interesting problems to solve. So it's
I see.
Yeah.
So maybe give me an example on this problem analogy you've stated on, say, the game you're currently working on. For quick context on the game, or maybe Jerry should explain it better. It's like a Indian mythical card battle game. But maybe, Jerry, you can explain what the game is. And maybe to help understand this distinction, what you highlighted, maybe give us an example of what you would create as a game designer, what interesting problem you would create for what a game programmer has to solve for.
Okay. So Kurukshetra Ascension, which is the game I'm currently working on, is a card battler similar to Hearthstone. Let's see. It's difficult because I worked on a lot of tiny features. I sort of joined the game after it was 70% done. I've been working on the game.
I see. Maybe we can pick another game if it's easier to explain.
Okay. Let's pick another game. Wow, man, I'm blanking. okay, I'll give an example from a game I worked on for Baiju's and EdTech game, right? This is probably not an exact answer to the question you asked, but there was this game where we had to teach kids maths, right? And they essentially had to sort objects to the right or left, depending on whether it was greater than the number that is on screen or lesser than the number that was on screen. And we were awarding points, but it was a speed game, right? Like, the faster you can do this, the more points you will get, right? And what I realized what was happening when kids were playing the game is they would just spam the left and right button. And because we were incentivizing speed, but we weren't incentivizing accuracy. So now the problem statement for me becomes, how do I incentivize accuracy in these kids, right? So that they think about what they're doing instead of just button spam, right? So what I did is I created this game mechanic where every four answers you get right, you get a multiplier. So if you get four answers right, you get two times the points. If you get eight answers right in a row, you get eight, like, three times the points. And then like that, it keeps like, and the longer your streak of accuracy, the more points you will get per answer. And if you ever get one wrong, then it slams back down to a multiplier of one.
Resets.
Right. So that was a game mechanic that I created, and then I implemented it in code as well. But then I went to a playtest in a classroom to see how kids were faring. And this one 11-year-old kid, he was doing it, but he was making mistakes along the way. And he got a high score that he was pretty proud of and that he was gloating about, right? His little brother, 8 years old, played the game after him, right? And this guy was playing slowly and carefully, and he completely decimated his brother's score. And he was like dancing all around and gloating about it. And I'm like, yes, a game mechanic that I built did what it was intended to do. And I managed to teach this child something without saying a word to him. I was just watching him. And I'm like, my work has done what I intended
to
do. That's an exhilarating feeling.
Wow, that is fascinating. So if I had to play that back to you, game design is essentially like designing the mechanics of or the rules of engagement within a game. A good game design is that rules of engagement results in the person doing what you intended that person to do. Whereas maybe not very good design results in them not doing it. And it has nothing to do with what the game feels like, what the game looks like. That is done by like different people.
Feel actually is part of game design, like, because there are sub disciplines in game design, that there is narrative design, there is experience design, there is feedback. So like the sound design is another, like it's a parallel thing.
I see.
But for example, like the way a screen shakes when an explosion happens, the vibrations and the haptics, that's all like sub disciplines of game design that a game designer is thinking about. And like, how do I give positive feedback to this player so that they realize that this was a smart action? How do I give negative feedback so that they realize that that is a bad strategy? And how do I create emergent experiences for them that keep them engaged? Game design is all about keeping players engaged.
Wow, fascinating. Oh man, whoever thought it would be like such a big world. But okay, we'll talk a little bit more about game design in a bit, but let's maybe come back to your time at CMU. You were at CMU, you first time you were studying game design. Talk to me about like your highlights. What were highlights at your time at CMU? And then maybe we'll talk a little bit about lowlights. What did you enjoy the most at your time at Carnegie Mellon?
Wow, man, that's a difficult question. But CMU is a playground for the mind. It's exhausting because like the assignments come one after the other. And you only feel the burnout when you have like sudden like week, a few days off, and you like realize I am fucking exhausted. But so the way my first semester worked at CMU is I got put into, a room full of smarter people, right? And the teams, we were split into teams of five or six people. And usually there were two programmers, two artists, and one sound designer on the team, right? Every 2 weeks, we got a new team of people, diverse team of people to work with. And we got a new piece of hardware and a new design problem to work with. So for example, the 1 week they gave us the Oculus Rift, which is a VR headset. And then they would say, make a game where you have to help a character. Right? Where you need to help another NPC. Like the design problem is you need to make a game about helping the character somehow. Right?
I see.
And then another week we were given the Xbox Kinect, which is like tracks body movement, and we're like, make a game that requires no instructions. I should be able to put this in front of a grandma. She should be able to figure this out herself and be able to play it. And at 1 week, we would have a checkpoint where they would see like the partial progress of this and give us feedback on it. So every week we needed to make a build, right? And then get feedback on that build. And then at the end of the second week, we had to present the final experience. And it was always like we're racing against the clock. And we've got other classes to attend as well as this was going on. But building virtual worlds was an intense fucking class. And I learned so much about game design. And more importantly, teamwork. While I was working there, while I was studying there. So I thoroughly enjoyed learning from some of the best in the industry at CMU. Yeah.
Got it. Well, what about like lowlights? Well, what was like the hardest part during your time at CMU? How long were you at CMU?
2 years.
3 years? Two years. Okay. Well, what did you find like most challenging?
I think it wasn't CMU per se, but it was the homesickness. Because homesickness is a real thing, and I didn't believe. I thought it was just a word that described.
Yeah.
But you feel it, like a deep loneliness that sort of sets in over time, a longing for belonging. And because everything was so fast, right? There was no building, or there was very little building of long-term and deep, meaningful relationships with people. In the sense that, because we only had 2 weeks until we had to move to the next group, right?
Yeah.
So most of the relationships that I built at CMU were like professional relationships.
Yeah.
Like, but there's no one I could confide in with, right?
Mm.
So I'm not sure that this is a universal feeling for everyone who goes to a foreign country, but I lost my sense of belonging for a little bit, and I felt lonely.
I actually hear that quite often, even especially with people who are, weirdly enough, they do their PhDs. I think I've heard this a few times wherein, you know, it is a bit of a lonely world wherein you're just, it's you and your work, right? And I think based on what you're describing, it seems a very intensive, like, experience. And then given that you're sort of rotating people every 2 weeks, I think you can be highly, like, engaged, but at the same time, I don't know, especially when you're away from home, right? It is. So I'm curious to know, like, what did you do to deal with that?
Okay, so there was this church in Pittsburgh that I would go to, Oakland International Fellowship, and there was this, I'm embarrassed to even like say this, but there was this Mallu group there, and they had...
Of course, are we surprised? There's a Mallu group everywhere.
Yes, so there was this group called Shalom, right? And every Sunday we would meet up, and then they would... In the evenings, we would pray in our own fellowship, and then I would go there because there was free food. Like there was good Mallu food at the end of the service. But the people were genuinely nice and helpful. They made me feel warm, welcome, and whenever like I needed help, like maybe moving from one apartment to another, there would be someone there who would bring their car. I made some genuine close friends there, and they felt like home. So, I mean, it's a little cliche that, you know, I go to a foreign land and then I hang out with the Mallu crowd, but it felt like home, and it felt more than, you know, a professional relationship. They were hanging out with me because they wanted to be with me, and it was like a home away from home. Very nice.
Yeah, absolutely. I think even here, when I stay in Singapore, sometimes there are days that I will behave more Indian. I will want to be more Indian than I maybe am. Because you just like, you miss home so much, whether it's been food or it's like, I would like crave for Indian food sometimes. Like, I was never a big like fan of Indian food. I mean, I would like it. Well, that was the only food I would eat. But like now there are days wherein I just need to get some Indian food. Like I need a fix.
What is your go-to Indian dish? Like for me, it's chole bhature.
I would say, so there is North Indian and South Indian. I do like South Indian food, but you know, however much I try to run away from it, I did grow up in the North. my palate is very, it loves the North Indian. There's like a North Indian restaurant there, which is very simple. They'll have like some, you know, ladyfinger, some bhindi, some aloo gobi and some dal. I love that. For South Indian, there's this great place. There are a lot of pretty big South Indian like population, like Tamil population in Singapore. Like idlis and vadas, these guys make it so good. sometimes when I'm craving it, I'm like, just gotta get that fix.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, so that was CMU. I'm curious to know, what does your curriculum look like for game design? Like your 2 years, what are the kind of things one studies when you're, you know, doing a master's in game design?
Okay. So the first semester is very different from the remaining three semesters, right? So first semester, like I told you, there was that building virtual worlds class, right? Where every 2 weeks you get a new team, a new project, and a new hardware to work on. That was what drained most of my energy and time in. There were other classes also, like visual storytelling, which was essentially a mini cinematography class, right? So you learned about how to frame things properly, how to use leading lines in the frame to sort of direct the player's attention, use colors to sort of imply certain things in moods, use elevation to frame a person in a position of power or of weakness. So there was like there were a lot of things that I learned in visual storytelling, right? Then there was also an improv class, right? Which essentially it helped us build sort of a teamwork muscle, right? Because improv is something that you kind of like, if to an outsider it seems like an extracurricular activity, but it's actually to build a sense of how can you take what this other person is giving you and to take it and make it more than it is, because otherwise you have to people who are uninitiated in that way of working, you sometimes be like, I have this great idea and I'm going to drive this scene, and like they take center stage, and that is in the long run I feel counterproductive, because like if you've got other talented, intelligent people around you, then they bring their own flavors to the table. And sometimes like it can get out of hand and be too many cooks can ruin the broth.
Yeah.
But usually it turns out more than the sum of its parts. If you just let things happen, take what people are giving you and then add more to it than it is on its own, suddenly you have something very interesting. So improv taught me how to essentially do teamwork. So that was all the first semester, right? In the second, third and fourth semesters onwards, they put you into like longer term projects, because what essentially happens in building virtual worlds is you build a game in 2 weeks, but then there's little or no scope for polish. So you can see how this is just like a clunky prototype, essentially.
Yeah.
Right. So for the remaining three semesters, we were put in class projects where we worked with companies. Like there was this school that wanted to make a game that sort of taught kids about rainforests. Right. And I worked for an entire semester with a team on building an app for that school to teach their second and third graders about rainforests. And in addition to that, you can take elective classes outside of that. So what then the doors sits, there is the Entertainment Technology Center in CMU, and then there is the rest of CMU. So I can take electives in any other discipline that CMU offers outside of the Entertainment Technology Center. So I took a script writing class, right? I took a robotics class. I took, there was an algorithms class that you would do, computer algorithms for data science at large, right? It's possible to bite off more than you can chew, right? But it's a playground for the mind. Like the doors sort of open. One thing that I regret not doing at CMU is so instead of letting CMU assign you to some project that you should work on for the rest of the semester, you can decide to intern with a company and essentially work with the company for the semester, and based on your delivery of work for that company and what you did, they grade you based on that, right? So I would have liked to, for one semester at least, work with a game design company, because that initial thing on your CV that, you know, I worked on this game,
is a huge
bonus. It would have meant like not being able to attend one of the extra classes that rest of CMU offers. And at that point, I'd actually weighed that more. Like, I need to learn how to write scripts for the CF, because I wanted to be like involved in narrative design as well.
Yeah.
But I feel like one semester, I should have gotten like a bullet point on my CV and said I worked on this game as an intern and managed to.
Yeah. Well, ever since you worked on many, many other games, so hopefully that's not something you're missing right now. I'm actually quite curious to know how the process of game design works. Like, for example, the example you gave when you have to design a game to teach kids to learn about rainforests. But we'll park that for now, and we'll come back in a bit. I do want to focus a little bit more about your time in the US. So you were at Carnegie Mellon. You spent 2 years there learning all of this stuff. Seems like it was quite an intense 2 years.
Yeah.
You then essentially worked for about a year and a half in the US and then felt that you wanted to come back to India. So I want to spend some time talking about that phase. Talk to me more about the kind of work you were doing in the US. What was like the most unique? This was also probably your first job, right?
Yeah.
You never worked in an Indian landscape. I do want to eventually sort of contrast that with what your experience in Bangalore has been.
Mm-hmm.
But tell me a little bit more about, you know, what did you do right after CMU, and what was that like?
So right after CMU, I worked for a while at Universal Orlando. And at Universal Orlando, they were building this around this time in 2016, 2017, they were building this new water park called Volcano Bay. And it was essentially a water park, but it was themed around being in a volcanic island, right? So there was this fake volcano at the center of the theme park. And then it was just waterfalls, but they shone like bright red and orange light through the waterfalls, so it looked like flowing lava and stuff. And it was a cool thing. And I got to walk through this water park while it's half done, right? And see the water slides come up and themes come up. But what they wanted me to build for them was an interactive attraction. Like they wanted, at the heart of the volcano, they wanted this volcanic spirit that was kind of like a tiki torch monster that spoke to guests and was like, "Welcome, children, to Volcano Bay." And it was the challenge there was that they wanted to animate this character's lips to match a performer's lips, because you can't script these things. They wanted it to seem like the guests there could have an actual conversation with this character that was alive and interacting with them. So
I see. If I'm visualizing this correct, this character was on a screen. Was it like a 3D character?
Yeah.
What was this character?
No. It was on an LED screen that was behind sort of transparent plexiglass thing that made it look like it was part of a tiki torch. So imagine a tiki torch's face coming alive, right? So
Got it.
There were cameras in the room, so the performer could see guests, what they were wearing, where they were standing in relation to the attraction. And then they were talking into a... So I got to make all these decisions. I said we'll work with an Xbox Kinect, because then I can do facial tracking, and then I can get a point cloud of what the performer's face is doing. It is relatively cheap. You don't have to buy $200,000 hardware to do this, right? So I got them to get an Xbox Kinect. And then from the Xbox Kinect, I got point cloud data of the player's face. And then I did some, like, this is where my physics training came in handy, right? I did some very fancy math that I invented to read the person's lips in real time. Like, essentially, imagine two points, like, very simplistically, a point on the top of your lip and a point on the bottom of your lip, right? And then a point on the left side of your lips, like left corner of your mouth, and a point on the right corner of your mouth. 4 points of data that will tell you how open your mouth is and how wide your mouth is. So I could, like, based on those 4 points of data, I could sort of tell if it's an U shape or an R shape or an E shape, right? And then now just multiply that. We're saying I've got hundreds of points that tell me where your lips are. Now I can make like a n-dimensional vector, like in multi-dimensional space, where I know exactly what shape your mouth is making, right?
Yeah.
And then based on that, I can animate between different like mouth shapes of the character. So I invented the maths to read lips, and then I made it happen in real time, because facial, like mocap technology is good, right? But even for films like The Lord of the Rings and Gollum and stuff, you record facial mocap, and then an artist goes in and refines the recording. Right, so there's refinements so that the animation looks real and believable. Right, so it requires artist intervention. But here, if a kid walks up to the character and says like, "Hi, Bob," and then the performer who's sitting a mile away has to be like, you there, child in the green shirt, step forth. Then it needs to happen in real time. So my math was lightning quick. And the attraction is still there. So if you go to Volcano Bay in Universal Orlando, say hi to Ball for me.
Wow. Wow. How long did it take you to build all of that?
About 6 months.
I see. Wow. Yeah. That is so fascinating. I was always, when you started, I was like, what is he doing in an amusement park? I thought he was supposed to make games. This makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so you spent some time working in the US, and you did mention that you reached a point where you were like, you didn't really feel it, and you wanted to come back to India. What was going through your mind?
That is a little bit annoying. So the thing is, this was right around the time when Trump was coming to power, right?
Mm.
So it was a little bit difficult for me to find employers that wanted to hire me full time and sponsor my visa and stuff. Even like Universal Orlando, they hired me essentially as a contract worker. I was not a full-time worker, which essentially means that I am a plumber or an electrician that comes into work there. And then once my job is done, bye-bye. I don't get any company benefits, and there's no responsibility of the company towards my well-being, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was... like for the work that I did for them, I was in extremely skilled labor. I felt like they should have at least offered me a full-time job after the job was done, but no such thing. The capitalism there has gone a little bit out of control, to the point where it's dehumanizing. And I felt a little bit used at the end of it. You know what I mean? Like I got paid, but the reason I eventually decided to leave the US is because, like I said, the capitalism has gone a little bit out of control. In the sense, the healthcare system, like if I'm between jobs, I can't afford to live. You know, I'm type 1 diabetic, right? I've been diabetic since I was 14. So to between jobs, to be even able to afford insulin, I had to pay like $900 per vial. And I'm like, what the fuck? I can get that same thing for like just less than $12 here in India. Right.
Yeah.
And I can survive for 3 months. $900 is insane, and it's only getting worse. And I'm like, if this is a long term thing and I want to live here and then make a family here, I can't afford to not have healthcare at any point in time. I can't afford to not have a job at any point in time. And not to get dark, but I'm not sure I wanted to raise my kids there. Because of the gun violence that sprouts up every day. Like those people, the Second Amendment is very important to them, and it's a detrimental thing to their whole ethos. Like this, it's gotten to be a place where you are a little bit afraid constantly. Like even while I was at CMU, one guy had shot his girlfriend and then shot himself, a CMU student, and I'm like, and we. It was maybe like half a kilometer from where I was staying at that point in time. And when you think about living in the US in the long term, I'm like, I can't allow myself to live in this fear and anxiety constantly. Yeah. It sounds a little bit like, you know, the fox who said the grapes are bitter or whatever, the grapes are sour. I left the US eventually because, you know, my visa had expired and I was between jobs. But even as a long-term strategy, to think that you're living in this place that is constantly getting more and more unaffordable, and there is this constant shadow of danger over your head, I felt like I wanted to pursue game design, but elsewhere, not there. Like my eventual goal is somewhere like in Europe, like Denmark and Sweden. They're really good places for the indie game scene. Right.
Yeah.
And if I get an opportunity there, I'm going, because that's where I want to be making like indie games or AAA games. AAA games is eventually my goal in life, but not the US. Like I spent a year and a half there and I got burnt.
Interesting. Yeah, I think this at least living in Singapore, that's. you know, you don't think about the stuff. And of course, I think Singapore is one end of the spectrum wherein, you know, like for me, thinking about safety is not an active thought in my mind anymore. You know, say a friend is out, somebody's out, you're not actively thinking that, hey, something bad might happen. Like, you know, they haven't picked up their phone, you're not responding. It's okay. The thought of something bad might have happened just does not come up. And I think that's not ideal because the world is not like this. But then I look at the US and I think that's the other end of the spectrum, right? Wherein it is absolutely possible that this person just got shot because for no fault of their own, right? Somebody must have just like trying to shoot somebody else and you came in the way, right? And I was just like knowing, just having that possibility at the back of your mind for yourself. And then eventually, you know, when you have family and kids, I'm like, it is pretty insane to know that this could happen. And it happens, you know, like you said, half a kilometer from where you lived. So I'm guessing the final nail in the coffin was your visa ran out and you were like, you know what, anyway, I don't want to go here. So let me just pack up and come back.
Yeah.
I see. Interesting. Maybe let's talk a little bit about something less morose and dark. You said your eventual goal is to make indie games and AAA games. Talk to me about the games which you enjoy the most. What's your favorite game or the games which have inspired you the most?
I like puzzles and adventure narrative games, right? So Portal is way up there. I don't know if you've played Portal. You have Steam, right?
No, I do not have Steam.
Do yourself a favor and play Portal. Because essentially I don't want to spend time plugging another game, but the puzzle design in Portal is fantastic.
I see. What else? Portal is one. What is the adventure then, narrative ones?
So The Last of Us, I'm sure you've seen the HBO series
right
now. Yes. So the creative director on The Last of Us is a CMU alum, right? He's from my alma mater. A lot of people at Naughty Dog, like during my third semester, I think we went to see a bunch of studios in LA, people in Naughty Dog, people in Ubisoft, people in Insomniac. That I have a lot of alum that are all over the industry, which is nice. While I was watching Deadpool 2, I saw in the credits Nafisa Baker, and I'm like, no way. She was my senior, and then I looked up her LinkedIn and she had worked in Deadpool 2. So it's like a little bit of surreal experience when you see people from your alma mater essentially working on these other fantastic things that you look up to.
Yeah, and when you were talking a little bit about the job, I would imagine having a degree or having the skill of game design or any of the aspects of the broader theme of game design is a very valuable skill, right? So do you think finding jobs is hard as a game designer? I would imagine that, you could just, you're probably like a software engineer in today's world, right? You just choose what you want and you'll end up there. Do you think that's a fair statement?
That is, yes and no, because it is kind of a niche field. Only now people are kind of realizing that this is something viable. And parents will let their kids start to pursue these kinds of dreams. So I am still a talented person in a niche field. So now at this point, finding jobs is not as much of a struggle for me. But early on, fresh out of CMU, it was much more important that I had credits on my CV, games that I had actually worked on. A degree from CMU is good, but it's not enough because they value experience, you worked on this game that had reached this much of an audience, this is the stuff that you did. So over the past 7 years, I've built up that experience, it's gotten easier for me. But right out of CMU, it was initially difficult, even though I was right out of CMU. I still haven't gotten to be in a AAA title. A few of my friends from CMU have, and God bless them, but I'll admit to slight bits of jealousy. Because I feel like I didn't push hard enough to get onto a AAA game company in the early days.
I see. How do you define a AAA game?
That's an interesting question. I guess the budget would matter.
Okay.
Yeah, but I don't know exactly where the threshold lies between like indie small titles and AAA games. But I think
what's a ballpark? What's a ballpark budget of a AAA game?
Ballpark budget of a AAA game sort of starts at 4 or 5 million.
Wow.
Yeah. Games are expensive to make and it requires a lot of talent, a lot of focused talent, in the sense that, like I said, game design is a broad umbrella, and there are multiple disciplines within game design, like systems design, economy design, monetization design. I think monetization and economy design are the same. Then there is technical design, and you know, technical design is essentially what I do. But what I guess the distinction between indie studios and AAA studios is where in indie studios there is one designer wearing multiple hats and solving different problems, and but in AAA studios there is just one guy who's focused entirely on the economy. His job is to make sure that the economy is lively and it's creating great player engagement. So that guy's only problem statement is, how do I make a sustainable economy that is engaging for the players? And that helps build a lot more refinement. Like as a level designer, even like in big studios like Naughty Dog, there will be one team that's focused on just building one 20-minute level in the entire thing, right? So I don't need to worry about anything outside of this 20-minute level, and I need to make it as polished as possible. And that kind of focus really sort of brings out quality.
I see. Wow, this is like a totally different world. I'm just like, whoa, this is like fascinating. How do you know if you're like, you have the right skills to be a game designer and any aspect of game design? Like, say, you know, a 18-year-old kid is just listening to this, you're like, oh, that sounds cool, but I don't know. As you said, right, it's a niche field.
Mm-hmm.
How does one know that I should try game design?
I'm not going to give you a very comprehensive answer, but for me, at any point in my, like, deciding what to do with my career, right, I've always had, like, one guiding principle question that has sort of driven my decisions about whether to, like, for example, there was this point where, like, should I do an MBA or should I, like, pursue this game design thing, right? And I studied for the CAT and nothing came of it. But the deciding fact question for me exactly was, what kind of problems do I enjoy solving? Like, and am I good at solving those problems? So for me, creating player engagement was the kind of problem that I enjoyed solving and I was good at it, right? So some people are like, how the question for them is, do I enjoy creating immersive sounds? Like, do I enjoy bringing this scene alive with sound feedback and making sound design the thing? So you know, there've been points in my career where I've been offered jobs to, like, do gambling games and other things. Like, we'll talk more about that later, but for me, that wasn't the kind of problem I enjoyed solving, even though they offered more money. Like, I'm good at math, I'm good at probabilities, and I can probably create an addictive game player loop that will get players to spend more money and gamble more. But it's not the kind of problem I enjoy solving, no matter how much money you offer me. So it's about constantly following the problems you enjoy solving. And then if that fits into game design, then that's what you should follow.
I see. Fascinating. There are two tangents I want to go down. One is what your beliefs on crypto is, because apparently there's a lot of chat on crypto x gaming, but we'll come to that in a bit. Let's talk about the gaming scene in India. You were in the US, you spent some time with, you know, the best of the best AAA studios. You then have been in India for, you know, 5-6 years now. And as you sort of mentioned, I think the India gaming landscape has been evolving.
Yeah.
From, you know, the Dream 11s and, you know, a lot of gamble-esque to even the stuff you're working on right now, right? It is trying to be, you know, a AAA or it's trying to be a global quality game. I think with the ban of Chinese apps in India, I saw there was a rise of, like, you know, PUBG ripoffs, which I don't know how good they were, but apparently they were pretty decent.
I worked on one of them.
Oh, you did work on one of those. Oh yes, I did look at it in your bio on the gangs one.
Yeah.
So talk to me about gaming in India. What have you sort of seen in the last, 5 years? What are you most excited about, and what are you least excited about gaming in India in 2023?
Right. So when I came back to India in late 2017, the gaming scene was a little bit sad. Like, it was mostly gambling rooms, Rummy Circle, Teen Patti, and shit like that. And like I said, there was money there and they were eager to hire me. But I didn't want to lend my talent and my time to that kind of experience, right?
Why? Because you don't agree with those games, or do you just think they were not fun problems to solve?
They're not fun problems to solve. In the sense key, like when for example, when we were at CMU, there were just two rules about the games that we cannot make, right? Don't make any shooting games and don't make any pornography games. And it's not because they have anything fundamentally against like shooting or pornography, but they're boring. Like there's no innovation there. Everyone has made a shooting game, and pornography is just like, it's not solving an interesting problem. You're not doing anything innovative. So they're like, you can do that if you feel like, but it's not creatively stimulating. So do something a little bit more ambitious with your creativity, right? So that's essentially my problem with gambling games. Do something a little bit more ambitious with your creativity. So I didn't want to spend time making gambling games. But to me, mathematics and physics is something near and dear to my heart, right? And I enjoy teaching. Like before I went down this whole rabbit hole of game design, the plan was to be a physics professor, because I enjoyed creating... describing analogies that sort of suddenly made an idea come alive in your head and understood it differently. I'll briefly go down a rabbit hole of good analogies in physics to sort of talk to you about space travel. But that was the initial plan. I forgot where I was going with this conversation.
We were talking about game. We were talking about gaming. So you came back to India. The gaming scene was pretty mad.
Yes.
All Teen Patti and Rummy.
Yeah.
Want to lend your talents to that.
Yeah. So then I really am passionate about maths and physics. And I thought EdTech is good for that. Right? If I'm making games that teach maths and physics to kids in interesting and important ways, then that's a valuable use of my time and talent. So for a while, I worked at QMAP, I worked at Byju's.
I have to pause you there, by the way. When you told me that you were working at Byju and QMAP, Bhamini, who was just on the pod, also worked at the exact same two
yes,
places.
Yes.
I was like, how small is this world? But anyway, you can come back. You did Byju?
Yes.
Okay. We worked at Bhamini, we worked at Byju and QMAP.
Yes. We'll talk about Byju's and QMath also. There's so many tangents in this conversation that I'm not sure where to take this. But let's first talk about the dream lectures I had in my head when I was studying physics, right? There are two analogies that I picked up on that I used to explain to even my nephews and nieces. And I've made illustrative games that illustrate this idea. So a lot of people, they think gravity works differently in space and then it works on the ground. Because otherwise, why don't the planets fall into the sun, right?
Yeah.
Why do they stay in orbit? And it's not that they work differently. So I'm going to just go down this tangent and explain a analogy to you. Imagine.
Okay, sorry. Before we go to the analogy, can you tell me, you were at Byju and QMath.
Yeah.
Was this your job to create analogy-esque?
No,
okay,
it was my job to create games that illustrated important concepts in maths and physics.
I see. And the gravity was one of these concepts you were trying to illustrate.
Yeah, that was a prototype that I had made. It didn't eventually make itself into the app, but it was essentially what got me the job at Byju's. So I had made this prototype and they were like, this is the kind of stuff we need. And this guy seems talented, so let's bring him on. He's got a bachelor's degree in physics. He respects both maths, physics, and game design. Let's bring him on, right?
Okay, now tell me the analogy.
Yeah, so imagine that you you have Superman's arm, right? And you're standing on the tip of Mount Everest, and you're tossing rocks down to see how far out you can throw the rocks, right? So you toss the first rock, and then it hits the bottom of Mount Everest. And then you're like, I wonder if I can hit the next mountain, right? So then you pick up the next rock and you toss it and it hits the next mountain. And then you toss it further and further and further until you wonder, can I toss it over the horizon, right?
Mm.
So then you toss it and it falls and then it keeps falling and it falls over the horizon and it keeps falling and eventually it comes and hits you on the back of your head, right? So it's not that the gravity is working differently. It's that you have, this thing is falling sideways and gravity is just trying to catch up with it. And it's falling sideways at like 7 kilometers per second. And you've reached orbital velocity, right? And that is an important thing that people sort of fail to realize when they're thinking about launching satellites into space, that you only need to thrust upwards, right? You don't. You need to thrust upwards and sideways and get yourself high enough and moving sideways fast enough to be outrunning gravity. And I made a game version of this, and I just hired me.
Fascinating. So coming back to gaming in India, you figured that the best place to land was in EdTech.
Yeah.
You spent time in Baiju. You just like shared about how you got in there. You spent some time in QMath. We can maybe talk a little bit about your time at Baiju, because I did ask Bahamini about it. But what did you enjoy most about your time at these EdTech startups? And I know you told me that it got kind of boring towards the end.
Yeah.
And therefore you sort of moved on. But what did you find most exciting at these EdTech companies?
I really enjoyed teaching maths and physics initially, because the games that I was making, it was games that I wish I had when I was learning these things, right? And it was very exciting and interesting problems to solve, right? To find ways to teach kids these concepts through gameplay. But I'll tell you, like, a distinction in the company ethos of QMath and Baiju's. Like, QMath, their principle was, let's teach kids math as a life skill, right? So that they genuinely, like, whenever they encounter a problem, they can analyze it logically and sort of deconstruct it and come up with a valid solution to the problem. And that is genuinely like a switch in your mind that flips once you've solved enough interesting math problems. Like, now instead of just guessing at what the probable solution should be, I should be like, what is the right question to ask? And then how do I solve for that question? So the whole mentality that went into QMath was, let's make kids better human beings through math, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, teach them math as a life skill. Baiju's, on the other hand, was like an education bazaar. They're like, your kids will be left behind if they don't consume our content. We have the best content, and you need your kids to have our content. Otherwise, your kids will just be left behind in the dust.
Mm.
And I can't fault them for their content, because they genuinely hire the talented people. The content is thoroughly vetted, and the content on their platform is something that you won't find for free on YouTube. I at least at that same production quality, but they don't give a shit about the kids. Like, honestly, they at some point they're just customers, and their parents are the customers whom they have an entire sales team that just emotionally like wrenches the parents and be like, listen, your child just, you don't want your child to be left behind by the rest of the class. Everyone's here at Baiju's. We have the best content. Let's bring your child here so that they can keep up. So it left a bad taste in my mouth. And eventually, there's only so many ways you can teach maths and physics, like addition and subtraction and multiplication to kids before you're like, please give me a more interesting problem to solve, right? Honestly, at Baiju's, game design for them is a buzzword. It makes for a nice slide on the investor pitch deck that, we're making games with computer vision to teach kids maths and physics. But beyond that, they don't really care what we're doing, and they don't. There's not an expectation for us to really deliver. Like, we wasted a lot of time at Baiju's, and eventually we were just a buzzword and a talking point. That team, and when things went downhill for Baiju's, like when things started going downhill for Baiju's, that team was the first to be chopped off and eliminated. Right? It was, so I was out of there by then, but Yeah, it Byju's is a little bit predatory in the way it pitches to students.
Interesting. Yeah, Bhamne and I, of course, had a long conversation on, I think, the role games can play in education. And I think she has, I don't know if you've spoken to her, but you must absolutely, I think, sync up with her. She has some pretty interesting thoughts on just gaming in education and the way each can help each other out.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so we park that for now. Let's talk a little bit about crypto, because I personally am a big crypto. I'm very into it.
Yeah.
I've heard that the gaming world hates crypto. Is that true?
No, there are a lot of companies that are working on play to earn mechanics, right? And it's an interesting space. I personally am also an investor. I hold a little bit of Bitcoin and Ethereum.
Yeah.
But I feel like the motivations for play get a little bit perverted when you bring money into the equation.
Correct.
So for me, I'm building games for players to just like, they come back at the home at the end of the day and they just want to like escape into this world where they are playing, relaxing, and engaging with different game mechanics. Now, when you turn that into a dhanda, and you're like, now you can earn money faster if you do these certain things, then you introduce a little bit of anxiety into the space, because people are no longer playing for themselves in their own escape. Like it should feel like sitting down and reading a book that by the lamplight with a warm cup of coffee. You should feel comfort and escape from work and anxiety. But now when you've made gameplay also a means of earning in a dhanda, then people are not playing for themselves anymore. They are performing for other players, and they are it becomes an extension of the rat race, which is fine. Like it's a valid way to earn money. But the kind of experiences that I want to create for players is not that. So I will fuck with crypto, but I will not fuck with play to earn.
I see.
Yeah.
But assuming we keep play to earn aside, is there anything with the whole, you know, philosophy of crypto wherein own your assets, interoperable, you know, any of that? Do you see that applying to, you know, the way you're thinking about gaming? Does that create a new paradigm? Just like, you know, for example, AI now creates a pretty new paradigm wherein you could just whip up, you know, these environments. I've heard of examples wherein designers design 3 or 4 characters and they tell the AI to, hey, design 20 more characters with this vibe, and it does it. With crypto, do you see any new sort of shifts, leaving play to earn aside, which is like over-financialized gaming?
Mm-hmm.
But the sense of ownership, the sense of, you know, interoperability, you have a game asset in this game, you can move to that game. Do you see that, you know, translating into work, or is this again, this is just
no? I think it's
talk.
I think it's important because normally if the marketplace is controlled by the developer, essentially. So if I want to sell my asset, then essentially Steam takes a cut, right?
Yeah.
And then it sort of puts up walls of exchange of assets between players that shouldn't be there. It should be a transaction between one player and another. The smart contract in NFTs, for example, can just ensure that 5% of that transaction goes to the company that initially developed it. But I think it is an important step in democratization. I don't know if that's the right word. Democratization of the marketplace. Just like it makes it a more open and free market, and I'm all for that.
Got it. Yeah, because I think crypto land, there's a big narrative wherein, you know, there's always a question in crypto world on, hey, what will bring the next 1 billion users into crypto? You know, initially we thought it was like DeFi, that did not work out. Then sort of NFTs, even though, you know, people argue wherein, you know, why do people want to collect these damn stupid monkeys, right? And I think the argument is that was sort of a way where a lot of people came into crypto. Some people don't even care, like, it is crypto, it's just something cool, it just happens to live on crypto infrastructure. But, you know, of course, that also got a bit financialized, did its job, but to some extent. And I think now that the hope or the bet is that maybe games, or like better kind of games can, you know, bring the next billion people into crypto, wherein the goal is not to tell, let people know it is crypto, but it's just built on crypto infrastructure and small things you take for granted, wherein, hey, I want to trade assets. It happens on that infrastructure, but you're not actively aware about it. So I'm always curious to know what the people in gaming actually feel about it, because there is this, you know, there is at least what on the sources of content I consume, there is this narrative that gamers hate crypto for exactly the reason you mentioned, which is it is financialized, something which is not supposed to be entertaining and fun, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I think we will stop talking about gaming. Mm-hmm. If you are not interested in gaming, this probably has not been very fun for you, but for me, it's always been, I used to love playing games a lot. And I think I, of course, stopped. But now in retrospect, I can see the value of a lot of it. I think it's actually not a waste of time at all. I think you learn so many things, especially if like, games are designed well, I always tell myself that I'll get back to gaming, but still very far. Anyway, a few more things I wanted to talk about. I think the first one is, you mentioned to me in your voice note that the current work you do seems to be at that intersection of the stuff you like, the stuff you get paid for, what you were meant to be. Talk to me a little bit about that. You seem to be quite content with the kind of work you're doing. Was it a realization? Was it maybe a role? How did you find yourself at, or feel that you were at right at this bang in the center of all of those Venn diagrams? I think it's called Ikigai or something like that, wherein you're right there in the middle.
Yeah, I've been fortunate in that respect, because a lot of people can't afford to pursue their dreams. Like there are people who do jobs that they feel are dead-end jobs and not really what they want to do because it pays the bills. And my parents were reasonably well off, so they were able to afford to send me to CMU to pursue this dream. But I think again, going back to that important guiding question that's always guided me through my decisions, it's always been either this or this. And the decider between this or A or B has been which of them leads to questions I enjoy solving, like problems that I enjoy solving, problems that I'm good at solving. So like whether that goes all the way back to school, whether should I do science or should I do commerce? And science had like physics and maths, and I enjoyed solving those questions, and I followed that path. Then while I was doing physics, it was like, do you want to do theoretical physics and quantum mechanics and statistical physics, or do you want to switch gears and then pursue this game design thing, you know, like the game design thing, right? So that one question that leads me to problems I enjoy solving has helped me throughout. And I think that has serendipitously led me into this like place where I'm building games now for a living. It's a very nice, contented place to be. A lot of people, like, even like in their late like 50s, still don't know what to do with their lives. And I count myself fortunate that I have followed roads that have led me to this place where I am today. There's a long way to go, but I'm not unhappy where I am.
That is so good to hear. Do you think you're going to be doing game design for the foreseeable future?
Oh, for sure. there's a long road ahead that I still have to travel.
What do you think is the next milestone?
The next milestone will be something that I have made that is playable on the console. So I want to be eventually making PlayStation and Xbox games. So my Kurukshetra Ascension is already on Steam, but I want to now start making console games, and whatever opportunities lead to that place, I'm going to follow.
I see. Is it very different making like PC games versus console games?
It is, because the interface is different, like the control schemes is different.
Oh, right? You can do more things.
Yeah. So the building for mobile has its own challenges, because like if you're giving feedback, then some of it is hidden underneath the thumb.
Yes.
So each platform has its own challenges, and then each platform is good to deliver a certain kind of experience, right? So I want to now deliver experiences for the console.
Well, what do you think is the hardest platform to build a game for?
It's a tough question, but I once built this game that used eye tracking technology, right? And because this was at CMU, and we had to use an eye tracker to do this, and it was essentially like it was a little bit difficult to solve for because the eye tracking is better when you're surrounded by darkness and your eyes are the only thing that are reflecting light. So it was an interesting experiment, but a difficult experiment to really do well. Yeah,
that is so fascinating. Okay, let's talk a little bit about what we mentioned about it right at the starting, about mischief. why did you send me that note on mischief? You said you had some thoughts and you wanted to share some stuff on mischief.
So there's something that when we grow up, right, it happens at different points for different people, that when they grow up, they start following these rules that no one told them need to be followed. Right, and behaving in certain ways and restricting the ways they behave because there is a societal norm that they feel they need to follow. But I think if you just give yourself the permission to be mischievous every now and then, right, life is so much fucking better. So much fucking better. Like, I have this niece, right, and I won't mention her name here, but once let's call her, I have two nieces, let's call one the naughty niece and one the stuck-up niece, right?
Okay.
And, the naughty niece and I, we were just like laughing about something and planning like a prank or something. And we were out in a cafe and we were just giggling loudly with each other. And the other one was like, shh, don't laugh loudly. And I'm like, who told you not to laugh loudly? And it's not like we were creating a disruptive ruckus or anything. It's just like, I felt like she had put herself in a little cage in her mind. And she was happy to just stay inside that cage. And I'm like, come outside and laugh with us. Come outside and dance with us. Come outside and create mischief with us. It's so much better. It's hard to explain these things without going into specifics.
So give me a specific. When was the last time you were mischievous? And what were you up to, Jerry?
So
guilty as charged, huh?
So I have a skeleton in my closet. Like a literal skeleton in my closet.
Literally? Oh my God.
I bought it from this like medical college that was getting rid of its own old equipment because they bought
God, so a legit skeleton, not even like toy skeleton.
No, a plaster of Paris skeleton. But like, but they had gotten like a legit skeleton and they wanted to get rid of their own stuff. And I'm like, this is a perfect opportunity. So I bought it and then I kept it in my colleague's chair at Baiju's. And Bhavna, Bhavna has worked with Bhamini, right? And she came back and we had a good laugh about it. And so what I did with that skeleton now around this previous Halloween is that with Rishi has been on your podcast and he's a dear friend, right?
Yeah.
So what we did is we bought like this white nightie, right? And this fake wig. And we put it on the skeleton and then we like stabbed holes in the white nightie and we made fake blood, right? This, I'll tell you the perfect recipe for fake blood, right? Fake blood's best recipe is you take red food coloring, given, chocolate sauce, like Hershey's chocolate syrup, because that brown adds a little like metallic, rusty color to it. It takes it from a campy, like cartoonish red to a deep crimson that feels really realistic, all right? And then water and Fevicol for consistency. So water for dilution and Fevicol so that it coagulates a little bit. So these four things together make like the perfect fake blood. We mixed it up and then we put it in the stab wounds and then we hung it up in my basement, right? And then the next day, like all the kids were running around screaming around it and it got confiscated by the guards. But then on Halloween, every kid in the colony came to my house and we gave them candy and they took pictures with the skeleton. I call him Freddy, right? I got into a little bit of trouble with the society guards. Because they're like, how can you put a skeleton in the basement without asking us? I'm like, I can put anything in my own garage without asking you. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
But they confiscated it and we got it back. But then my house was the most popular house for Halloween, right? And I made a lot of kids smile. Like I must have like traumatized a few of them, but most of them were smiling and laughing and coming to my house. And I gave them a fuck ton of candy. So that was wow. One recent piece of mischief that Rishi had.
Nice. Oh, so Rishi also is in Bangalore right now, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, nice. Wow, you guys are still friends all these years later. That is so cool. Okay, as we wrap up, Jerry, as you look back over the last decade, have there been any shifts in belief? And by shift in belief, I mean something you would believe very strongly. And now you have like a 180 degree shift in that belief.
This is a little bit embarrassing to admit, but I used to be a little bit homophobic, right? Mm-hmm. And when I went to CMU, I realized that a lot of people that I've been working with are gay, and it makes no difference whatsoever. Like I realized they were gay after the fact that I had gotten valuable relationships with them. Like I respected them as people, as professionals, and I looked up to them. And then in sort of casual conversation, it came up that they were homosexual, and it stopped mattering to me because I realized they're not any different. Even people we went to college with, like after the fact, I won't name names, but some of them have come out and I'm like, I already love and respect this person. Like, why should that change? So right around 2014, around that time, it sort of dawned on me that it doesn't really matter. And I shouldn't be like bringing any prejudice into that relationship just because of who they choose to love. So that was an important change that happened sometime.
Interesting. Fascinating. Okay, two pieces of advice you would have for 18-year-old Jerry.
Oh, shit. Two pieces of advice. Okay, you're going to have your heart broken a couple of times. It's okay. You'll be fine. Pick yourself up, put yourself back together, and you'll be in a good place eventually. It's going to be all right. And another piece of advice that I would give Jerry is get on a continuous glucose monitoring system faster. So diabetics, right? Our blood sugar can go up and it can go down also. When it goes down, it's really dangerous, especially like if you're asleep and you go down, it can cause like brain damage and stuff. So a continuous glucose monitoring system is essentially a glucometer that's attached to your body, and it keeps like every 5 minutes sending like, this is what your blood sugar is, to your phone. And if your blood sugar goes out of range, then it'll start beeping, right? So I went to the hospital once because I went low at night while I was at CMU. And only after that did I start on the continuous glucose monitoring system. And it's helped bring my blood sugar into a lot better control ever since I've gotten it, right? And it's helped me maintain a much healthier lifestyle. So don't worry about your heart. It'll break and it'll fix itself. And get your blood sugar in tighter control with a continuous glucose monitoring system.
Wow, that is so good. See, if I had a glucose monitoring sponsor, this would be the best plug for it right now. Damn, I should get one next time. Okay, anyway. Yeah. Jerry, as we wrap up, after all the quizzing I've done for you, you get to ask me one question. What do you have for me?
Okay. So I actually prepared for this because I heard your other podcasts.
Yeah.
So in everyone's mind, right, there's this book I'm reading called 13 and a Half Lives of Captain Blue Bear. But I won't go into that. But in everyone's mind, there is this place called the Valley of Discarded Ideas, where you have like ideas that you've had, and at some point you're like, that's a fantastic idea, but you don't do anything about it. And then these ideas are running around despondent, like, please do something about me. Like, I'm a good idea. Like, at least try me out. And you won't know until you've actually like put some time and effort into bringing that idea to life. And I have my own like Valley of Discarded Ideas for things that I really want to do, but I haven't ever put the time and effort. Like, I have got this book that I've written 30,000 words for, but I haven't ever like completed it. And like a lot of my friends who have read it, like Rishi included, like, please complete that book. But it's currently just like languishing in my Valley of Discarded Ideas. So I'm sure you have a Valley of Discarded Ideas in your head. 5 years from now, you will resent yourself when you look back at this conversation and you're like, I didn't do anything about that idea. Like, 5 years ago, I spoke to Jerry about this and I still haven't done jack shit about it. What is that idea in your Valley of Discarded Ideas?
Which 5 years from now I would not have done jack shit about?
or like something that you want to do something about but haven't yet.
Okay. Oh man, that's such a good one. I do have, similar as you said, I have a Notion doc with memos of all the ideas that I eventually want to do at some point, which I've not gotten down to. There are so many, but let me think of a few which come back up pretty often. So I think this is a bit, it's a little bit abstract, but, and maybe the hardest to make into reality, but I think about this idea quite a bit. I think let me describe the problem statement. The problem statement is that I think individuals, as you grow older and older, unless you're very proactive, you do not build a strong enough set of people who can guide you through different aspects of life. Okay. I think sometimes you rely on your manager at work. Sometimes you rely on your friends. Mostly, you know, at least like in Indian maybe societies, you rely on your parents, right? You do not actively build a set of people or you know, I won't use the word mentors, but sort of sounding boards who can sort of help you with certain decisions, and you're trying to like reinvent the wheel. Everybody's trying to reinvent or figure it out themselves. The best analogy of this is having a board of directors at a company. So every CEO, right, for example, they have a board of directors. And typically, you know, CEO advice is that, you know, build a diverse set of board of directors, and know each of your board of directors will give you feedback or advice on a different aspect of the company. They will not give you the same. So as an example, if you want to talk about finance, you go to this person. You don't go to the other person. But if you want to talk about, say, people, you go to that person. Don't go to the other person. I think that concept, and, you know, people have talked about this on different podcasts, is every individual, I believe, should have a board of directors. That means a set of people who they can essentially confide and go to with certain decisions they need to make. And each of these board of directors would help you with a certain part of life. I won't say the word help, but given that they have more experience, given that they have probably lived through those experiences, might be able to guide you through that. There would be board of directors who help you have a conversation with money, with family, or with work, with health, mm-hmm, with relationships. And, you know, just to sort of superimpose it on this another concept of 2-5-10, wherein you think of people who you want to take advice from, or, you know, just go to get some feedback. You should always ideally have somebody who's 2 years ahead of you, 5 years ahead of you, and 10 years ahead of you. Because mm-hmm, the kind of feedback they would give you is very different. Each of them valuable, but very different. The person who's 2 years ahead of you will give you very tactical feedback. You know, do this, 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 you will go from point A to point B. The person 5 years ahead will give you a bit more tactical, but a bit more medium thought, like a thought process. Whereas the person 10 years ahead will give you very like meta, which can maybe, you know, make small changes right now, but effectively change your trajectory of life, right? So one of the ideas I have in, as the amazing term you choose, which is the valley of death, is to create a way wherein people can build these board of directors, or build these people or these individuals around them to help them. And I don't think anybody has answers, but I feel if you're trying to play this as a single player without taking feedback from people who've already done this, it's a very inefficient solution.
Sure.
So yeah, that's one of the ideas I would say is what I would hopefully build at some point, because I personally would love it, right? I would love to have 5-10 people who I look up to in different aspects of life. And it's unlikely that this person will be one person. It's right. Surely not your parents. It is sometimes often not your friends, because they are figuring out themselves. But there are these individuals out there in the world who are happy to spend time with you. And they will be able to advise you on one very specific aspect. You should not take advice from them on other things, because, you know, sometimes people are good on one thing and pretty bad on the other thing. So never look at them as holistically. Mm-hmm. So anyway, long story short, that's one of the ideas in my valley of death, which I would like to build at some point.
Valley of discarded ideas.
Yeah. Valley of discarded ideas. That's a good question. Hopefully 5 years later, I don't look back to this conversation and be like, fuck, I've been talking about it for 5 years.
I've been talking about my book for like 10 years now. But anyway, I had a lot of fun.
What's stopping you from completing it?
What's stopping me from completing it is, I guess, time. But that's an excuse I've been giving for 10 years now, so I don't think it's a valid excuse anymore. there is...
Can you share what the book is about?
It's about a cat trying to catch the moon. Like, and he spends all of his 9 lives trying to catch the moon, right? So initially he tries, he's born in ancient Egypt as the Pharaoh's cat, and he tries to pray the moon down to him and build pyramids up to the moon, fails and dies and is killed by the Egyptians. And then at every point in his life, right, he sort of does something to inspire someone who, like, at some point he does something to inspire Newton to, like, write to describe gravity. At some point he inspires the creation of the steam engine in the car. At some point, like, so at different points in his life, like, at some point he sort of uses Ferdinand Magellan to sort of chase the moon around the globe, hoping to catch it as it's, like, dipping below the horizon. So each of his 9 lives he spends, like, wasting, essentially, trying to catch the moon. And by the time he's reached his 7th life, he's like, have I just been wasting my life at something that is completely unattainable, right? And then he essentially tries to settle down. He initially tries committing suicide, but he's like, what would be the point of that? And then he tries settling down. But eventually, when everything that he has done building up to the space exploration sort of leads up to the Apollo mission, then he's like, I am fucking getting on that spaceship. And then eventually he gets to the moon. And then at some point, he's like, I'm here, now what? And then he looks up at the earth beneath him and the stars above him, and he climbs back onto the spaceship to see what lies ahead. And eventually, curiosity kills the cat.
Curiosity kills the cat! My God, that is an epic, epic end! Oh my God! Oh wow!
Yeah.
I know people who struggle with writing books. Sometimes what they do is they will start emailing chapters. So you never release the book. You release a chapter.
Oh.
And then that feedback, you know, pushes you to be like, oh, you know, you'll have 100 people more telling you, complete the book. We want to read it.
Yeah.
Maybe that's something you could try. But I would love to read this book. Just for the curiosity kills the cat.
Yeah, man. So maybe we'll sync up again in 5 years and I'll see if you've released your board of directors, and you can see if I've released my book.
Oh man, well, I hope for both of us that we have done. Anyway,
yeah,
Jerry,
yeah.
I think this is a good place to end. Thank you so much for making time. It has been a fantastic
conversation. Yeah, man, it's been a lot of fun talking to you.
Yeah, if people want to keep up with the stuff you're doing, how should they, what's the best place to follow you?
Best place to follow me. I have a YouTube channel on which I occasionally release development content and ukulele videos. I've got Ukulele Mumilele. It's my, like, YouTube thing. I guess LinkedIn and YouTube. Just look for Jerry T. John, you'll find me.
Okay, I'll leave the links in the show notes, and you can find Jerry, and hopefully we read your book very soon. Anyway, thanks again for making time, man.
Thanks, man.
And that's a wrap. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review or just follow us on your podcast player. If you'd like to hear more from me, subscribe to our newsletter or follow us on Instagram. You can find all the links in the show notes. I upload new episodes every alternate week, and I'll see you next time.